Welcome to another episode of Good Night Tanzania with myself, Osama. Good Night Tanzania is a podcast meant to help ordinary South African people understand a little better where they're from historically, so that we together can come to understand the present. On all social media platforms, I am Osama Simone, and the podcast is Good Night Tanzania. I hope you'll like, subscribe, and comment with your views so that I may know what you think, of course. Let's see what's on the menu today. Welcome to another episode of Good Night Tanzania. Today, we're going to be talking about farmers. Last week, we were joined by John, who spoke at length about people from the Stone Age era, and obviously giving us a lot of background towards that, and then also linking it to the past 10,000 years, I suppose, in the Southern African region, how at the time, you know, the archaeological evidence points to the fact that people around the area were hunter-gatherers at the time, and they obviously lived, you know, that kind of lifestyle and all of that information. You can find the episode on the list. But when John was speaking about that, he mentioned obviously that eventually in the record there appears farmers. But obviously we didn't go at length on that topic because there was so much else to talk about at the time. But today we are going to be doing exactly just that. We're going to be looking at the earliest farming societies in South Africa. We're going to be asking questions about what they, you know, what, when they arrived, evidence there is of that, and so on and so forth. And to help us really get into, you know, those deeper details, we are fortunate enough to be joined by Gavin Whitehall. Gavin is the chief curator at the KwaZulu-Natal Museum in Pietermaritzburg. He joined the museum in April 1986 to work on the Inanda Dam archaeological project. His research focuses on the archaeology, the history, the anthropology, and the material culture of African agriculturalist communities of the last 2,000 years. Gavin did his undergraduate and postgraduate studies in archaeology at the University of the Witwatersrand. So Gavin, welcome to Good Night Tanzania, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much. It's good to join you.
Before we get really started on the episode, I'd just like to hear more about why you decided to become an archaeologist, and also just to have a brief reflection on your experiences, both as a researcher and as a curator.
I've been interested in archaeology even during my childhood. So it's quite a long-term interest. Although it wasn't my primary interest. I was principally interested in zoological things and environmental issues and so on. When I went to Basti in the early 1980s, that's what I wanted to do. I got sidetracked by archaeology mainly because I had plenty of time at Basti. I had time in my schedule, so I took an archaeology course just to sort of pursue that interest, and enjoyed it so much that I did reasonably well at it during my undergraduate years, and so decided to stay with it for postgraduate years. So I did an honors in archaeology. And then of course, it gets better because we were doing our own work. Me and my fellow honors student, there were just two of us, organized our own excavations. We went into the field with undergraduate students, and we wrote up our own excavations afterwards. And then just studying the subject in more depth during the honors year, of course, it becomes much more interesting. And we found that we could insert ourselves or offer our own interpretations of other people's work and so on. And yeah, it just became very interesting. So I stayed with it. And I was lucky in the sense that by the time I got to looking at a master's degree, this project in Natal came up, the Ananda Dam Archaeological Project. Now, this was in 86, and Ananda Dam was under construction at the time, and it's in the Umgeni Valley just outside Durban, about 30 kilometers from Durban, from the coast. And a bunch of early Iron Age sites were due to be flooded by the dam. And so Department of Water Affairs was funding a project to excavate those sites before the flooding, so as to recover as much research potential from them as possible. And you know, there was a small salary with that job, and so I got it, fortunately. I took it, shall I say, and spent the next 2 years in the field in the Umgeni Valley. The archaeology side of it was run by the Natal Museum in Pietermaritzburg. And so I moved to the Natal Museum in 88 to process the material. And I've just stayed here, basically. In Southern African archaeology, when one's an honors student, when you finish your honors, you can join the professional association. So I did that in 1986. I joined the professional association. And then obviously went to conferences to present the work from Ananda Dam and published the material eventually. And that's how I sort of became an archaeologist. It was kind of accidental in a way. It wasn't a goal for me when I started varsity back in 1981, but it's where I ended up. And I've been really lucky with the museum, now the KwaZulu-Natal Museum. I've been really lucky that it's provided a home for me since 88, really. Well, 86, actually, but I moved here at 88.
Yeah. And how have you experienced the work of doing archaeology in the context of a museum? And I don't know if it's different to working for perhaps like a university or like a different kind of institution.
I love it. I love it, actually. It is different. I don't often do lectures. And if I do lectures, they're public lectures to members of the public. So members, you know, people who are interested in the subject will come to, a public lecture on archaeology. It's not students who are aiming to get a degree. I don't very often supervise students. I've been involved in some postgraduate research. Two of my colleagues in the museum department are doing archaeology master's degrees, and I'm co-supervising their projects. And then of course there's museum displays as well. So it's really, the market is not students, but members of the public. And so whether they're interested and have some background knowledge, or whether they're coming in completely cold and have no knowledge whatsoever, as most museum visitors will do when they come and see the displays. So in a sense, one has to, as a museum archaeologist, you need to be able to interpret your discipline for members of the public in a way that attracts them to the discipline, makes it seem exciting to them, and yet remains understandable. So it's quite significantly about the translation of some complex archaeological concepts or ideas into words that untrained members of the public can understand. Kids can understand, really. That's what our ideal aim is, to get sort of young teenage kids. That's the sort of age that museum text is typically aimed at. So it's a different kind of challenge from teaching students in varsity, and it's a much more public orientated kind of job. And in our museum, it's very strongly research focused as well, and looking after collections as well.
And now to get into the more sort of technical stuff, how would you relate practices of archaeologists and, you know, and the method of archaeologists to the historical record in general. Like, I'm trying to understand the nature of archaeology as history, in a sense.
Okay, it's slightly complicated. See, archaeology is essentially the study of a human past through material remains, through the things that people have left behind. They've created and then left behind. So that's the kind of stuff that we call material culture. And our primary evidence is this matter. These are the residues of people's lives, the rubbish they've discarded, the things they've forgotten or lost, and the remains of their structures as well. So those are the things that is our core evidence. That stuff is our core evidence. And we usually collect that kind of evidence through excavation of archaeological sites, for example, or through the recording of, say, rock art sites photographically or by copying or tracing, or through the actual sort of detailed physical and chemical analysis of artifacts as well. So there's a range of ways we'll collect that kind of data. But what we also do is consider the ways that living people work in the world, as well as historical and anthropological accounts of various communities in various societies around the world. And obviously, if we're working on farming communities, sort of pre-industrial farming communities in Southern Africa, we're interested in communities that, if we're looking at living societies, we're interested in people who, in a sense, most closely, who live their lives in some kind of farming way that is not intimately linked to the industrial world. So we're not going to look at people who are involved with tractors and Monsanto and so on. Well, we may do. And those kind of things can help us too. But what we're really interested in is how people relate to material culture. We may want to look at the way potters create and distribute their wares through societies, or the role and status of iron workers in societies, or how and why objects are either stored in homesteads, how and why they're discarded in homesteads. And these kind of studies help us understand relationships, or rather the range of relationships that are possible between human beings and the material world, the objects they create. Mm. And so then we use this information to build models or hypotheses, which we can then apply to the archaeological residues. So there's a sense in which archaeological interpretation is kind of a reciprocal process between different kinds of data, you know, the data from living communities, from anthropology, from history, and from archaeological sites, and also these hypotheses that we create. There's a kind of reciprocal process, and through that we build interpretations that we think are probably the most likely or the best possible kind of interpretations. As far as history is concerned, it's a different kind of history or different kind of past we create from the one that's typically created by historians. The reason for that is because archaeological residues are most commonly created through repetitive action. People are repeatedly depositing stuff in one place. And so when we find that, we sort of dumps and we excavate them. So there's a sense in which there's a tendency for archaeologists to create pasts that are, they suggest greater stability in society or stasis, and there's less dynamism perhaps in the past that archaeologists might tend to create. So I think the answer for us there is to look at where one has to take kind of social perspective here and look at where the fundamental divisions within society might exist, where the challenges between sectors of society might come from, where the compromises are made, where there's conflict over resources and so on. And if we can target those kinds of things in the material record, if we can interpret the archaeological residues with those kinds of ideas in mind, we can in fact create pasts that are dynamic or more dynamic. So that's kind of the approach that I like to take.
Mm-hmm. I know currently we're aware that for a very long time, people were stone agers in the sense, like for close to like 3 million years, and people have been living an agro-pastoralist sort of way of life, which is farming and keeping animals for less than there have been stone age people. And within the context of Southern Africa, like I'd said in the opening, that there had been a long history of hunter gatherers in this place as well. When do farmers initially appear on the archaeological record of Southern Africa, and what evidence are you able to, you know, like is able to lead you to these insights?
It's around 200 to 300 AD in Southern Africa. So that's about 1800 to 1700 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the earliest sites occur in Zimbabwe, northern South Africa, in Eswatini, Swaziland, and Mozambique, southern Mozambique. So those are the earliest sites in Southern Africa. And they all date between about 1800 years ago and 1700 years ago. And they have, what we do find on those sites is pottery and various other residues, but the pottery is important for the moment. So I'm just going to talk about the pottery. It's a style that we call, there's a particular style of this pottery that we call silver leaves. The name comes from the first site at which this pottery was identified, which is in the, it's near Zinine. It's not far from Zinine in Limpopo, in northern South Africa. So I guess the farm is called silver leaves. And so we call this stuff silver leaves pottery. And silver leaves pottery looks something like a pottery style that we call Kwale in East Africa. And so the similarity between Kwale pottery and silver leaves pottery is archaeological evidence for the movement or the expansion of farmers southwards from East Africa into Southern Africa around about 1800, 1700 years ago. Now, apart from pots, which provide, you know, they people cook food in them, they brew beer in them, and they serve beer in them, the archaeological remains show that Sobolese people cultivated millet. They mined iron ore to make iron tools, especially hoes. They made buildings of wood and mud plaster, and they also dug deep storage pits, which we presume would have been used to store grain. They probably, I think, kept livestock too, but we have no certain evidence of this. But if we look at their descendants some 200 to 300 years later, those descendants definitely had livestock. They definitely had cattle and small stock, sheep and goats. One of the problems we have with silver leaf sites is that they occur on quite sandy soils that don't preserve organic remains such as bone very well. So thus far, no bone has been found on, no livestock bone has been found on silver leaf sites. Now, mm-hmm. Some archaeologists, I think that's a reasonable assumption to make, that they had livestock with them. But some archaeologists may not think that's reasonable. And some archaeologists like to look at the real concrete evidence. Is there cattle bone on these sites or not? And they might reject that kind of assumption that I think is reasonable in the absence of that hard evidence. But what the other thing that convinces me about these people being both cultivators and livestock owners is that on sites of 300 to 400 years later, some of them who are direct descendants of Sobolese people, we find exactly the same kinds of evidence and much more of it as well. And that evidence relates to pots, relates to storage, relates to iron production and cultivation. Plus, we have evidence of cattle, sheep and goats, dogs and chickens. We know how the homesteads were organized. We know where the cattle pens were, where the houses were, and we know where they stored grain. So I think it's most likely the first farmers in Southern Africa, the Sobolese farmers, and their close relations who came slightly later, brought the full farming package with them cultivation of a range of crops, livestock, and metallurgical skills. And of course, you have to remember iron hoes were essential for cultivation. And it seems like Thill believes people, as they move southwards, were seeking, deliberately seeking out iron ore sources, because some of the earlier sites are normally found close to iron ore sources. The best example of that is perhaps the most obvious example of that is the site in Eswatini, which is an iron mine, essentially, in the Ngwenya mountain range. That iron mine has silver-leaf pottery in it.
And what about origins? If it is clear that the people arrived at a specific point, like you've suggested, 1800 to 1700 years ago, where, I think you've hinted at this in your previous answer, where you are linking the pottery to Gwale tradition, I believe you said. But where are you able to trace these people back to? Where did they initially come from? And how are you able to draw these broad connections?
I think they probably had a single origin, but in two senses, they had a single origin. It helps that in Southern Africa, as I've sort of alluded to already and you picked up, is that we can use pottery style to track the movement of people across the landscape and through time. And the reason we can do that is because there's a relationship between, we believe we can see a relationship between pottery style and language, the language that people spoke. So people who speak the same language typically share a pottery style. So we think if they're related pottery styles, then they're probably speaking related languages. So tracing pottery styles back in time through to about 2,000 years ago, we can see that these, from today back to 2,000 years ago, to silver-leaf pottery, we can see that these farmers were almost certainly, I would say 100%, they definitely speak as of what we call the linguists call Bantu languages. So linguists tell us that the Bantu language family originated in the Nigeria-Cameroon borderlands in West Central Africa. And then from about 3,000 years ago, its speakers spread into the Central African rainforest first, and then eventually into the savannah region south of the rainforest. And as it spread, it diversified into regional groups or regional branches. And one of the branches, the eastern branch, the eastern Bantu branch, developed around the vicinity of Lake Victoria in East Africa. Alternatively, it's possible that the Eastern Bantu branch developed back in the sort of Nigeria-Cameroon borderland area in West Central Africa and spread separately to the Lake Victoria area in East Africa. And it's from there that we see, most archaeologists accept it's from that point that we see the movements and the expansions of farming southwards into Southern Africa. And there seem, if we look at pottery style, there seem to have been three major thrusts, I suppose, to this expansion, three clusters. One in the east through Mozambique to Southern Africa, one in the center through Malawi and into Zimbabwe, and one through the southern Congo, the western Zambia area and Botswana into Southern Africa. So you've got a west, a central, and an eastern spread. Silver leaves relates to is the first to reach Southern Africa, and that those people are the silver leaf people. Just slightly later, maybe 100 years later, the other people reach Southern Africa. Now what's happening, they're spreading into savannah environments. But of course, as one moves southwards through Africa, the savannah gets increasingly restricted to the eastern side of the subcontinent, and it becomes very dry in the west, and in some cases, desert in the west. And so as they move south, they come back into contact. These three clusters come back into contact with one another. And in Southern Africa, they're interacting. Communities of these different groups are interacting with one another and sometimes creating sort of merged pottery styles. We would suggest reflect merged languages. Now, you have to remember they're all from the same origin point. So although their language, these languages might be, that they're speaking maybe dialects rather than languages, and they might, the dialects might diverge with time. But of course, when they meet together, there's a congruence, a confluence of linguistically and pottery style happening again. Yeah, so I think they had a common origin, whether we think of that origin as in East Africa or in the Nigeria-Cameroon borderlands. And we know they were closely related. This relationship between, just as I give you an example, this relation, a really neat example, this relationship between pottery style and language, you can look at much later in farming history in Southern Africa. Take it to about 600 years ago, 1400 AD, in the Sopensberg area. And it's there that we see the emergence of the Venda language out of sort of convergence of Sotho speakers and Shona speakers. They come together and they create a new language, which is Venda. And we can track that convergence of linguistic convergence through the ceramics, because we see Shona style pots and Sotho style pots merging, two different styles merging to create a new style in the Sopensberg area around about 1400, 1450 AD. It's quite an extraordinary example of this connection between language and pottery style.
And what about space and ideology? Are you able, how have you been able to assess how people were distributed themselves across the landscape and the choices that they made, you know, for, you know, like specific, you know, distributions and how they made those and how are you able to make these assessments?
Well, they were farming people. So essentially they needed areas in which they could cultivate their crops. And all of their crops required summer rainfall. They were all summer rainfall crops. They, you know, the various kinds of millets, sorghum, various legumes such as ground beans and cowpeas, and gourds and so on, various cucurbit type plants. And all of these require rainfall in the summer months. And so that is the one, the rainfall restricted them in the first place. To be able to cultivate their crops, they needed the right amount of rainfall in the at the right time of the year. So it had to be in the summer rainfall areas, and it couldn't be a place that was too dry, where the rain was too, a little bit iffy, where it wasn't sufficiently regular, where it was too unpredictable. It couldn't be a place like that. And then they needed the arable soils as well. So from my experience, KwaZulu-Natal gives a really good example of this, because we have very sharp environmental distinctions between deep river valleys and high uplands. And what we see in the river valleys and along the coast, we see good arable soils, we see sufficient rainfall, and that is exactly where these people first lived. That the places they targeted were sort of low-lying river valleys on arable soils, where there was sufficient rainfall, that, you know, between 600 and 800 mils of rain per annum in the summer months. Mm-hmm. In addition, those same places contain sweet veld grazing all year round. So that was good for the livestock. And they had wood for industrial use, making iron, hardwoods, and also wood for domestic use, either fires or building houses and granaries and so on. Fences and such like. In addition, in KwaZulu-Natal at least, there's plenty of iron ore. So they had access to iron ore for producing hoes and spears and so on. You really need hoes in some of these hard soils, you know, these hard soils. You really need hoes to cultivate. So most of the iron would have gone into hoes. So that's their target. That's what they targeted. As I said, they were seeking, it seemed to have been seeking out where iron ore sources were, but once they nailed that down, they were choosing areas that where there was reasonable grazing, but definitely good potential for cultivating their crops. That's the one thing we know about. And then you mentioned ideology as well. One way we can get at ideology is looking at how they organized their homesteads, where they put their cattle kraals, where they put their houses, and the relationship between the two. And we think, I think, that we can see patterns that are evident today in South Africa, or historically in South Africa, the last 200 years, where people build a cattle pen in the center and arrange their houses, the houses of the wives around that cattle pen. We can see that same homestead organization back into the early Iron Age, into the first millennium AD. So we can use that knowledge to say something about how these people thought about the world. We believe, as a result of the presence of that homestead organization, that they were patrilineal, descent was through the father, and that they exchanged cattle for wives, the cattle-based bride wealth would be exchanged for wives. And that is, in fact, that's some of the key findings that came out of the Annandam project, looking at homestead organization in the first millennium AD. So ideologically, we have some fundamentals established for this early Iron Age period, these early farmers in the first 1,000 years. And then we have an idea of what they wanted, what they needed to have in terms of their agricultural requirements as well.
And what about interactions, intergroup interactions? I know, obviously, because you are working with a somewhat sort of limited data set, in that you're using just only material, you know, remains and not necessarily thoughts and words, right? But I'm wondering if you're able to, because I understand that there's a discontinuity between the farmers of the first millennium and those of the second millennium. But I'm trying to get a sense of what patches of information you've been able to gather to sort of try to piece together the nature of the interactions and between, you know, communities, and how people, you know, like engaged in within, you know, the political sort of domain and, you know, the social and the economic.
There's two, for the first millennium, there's two major kind of interactions. One is the one you mentioned, interaction with the second millennium farmers. So, and then the first one is the interaction with hunter-gatherers in KwaZulu-Natal, anyway. These are the two things we're looking at in KwaZulu-Natal. So I'm going to talk mainly from this part of the world here, where I know the data best and where I work. I suspect there are going to be a range of interactions. And as you point out, we don't really necessarily always have the right sort of data to get at that stuff. So the range of interactions might be much greater than we have actually got evidence for. But what it looks like here is, when they first arrived in this part of the world, is that hunter-gatherer communities actually changed the way they moved across the landscape and actually made contact with farmers who were settled in the sort of low-lying river valleys. There's a sort of spike in intensity of hunter-gatherer deposits in those river valleys at the same time that the farmers arrived there, which is really neat, because where the hunter-gatherers had been dominant before in the grasslands and in the mountainous regions, there's a drop-off in intensity of their occupation residues. So it looks like they physically actually shifted at least part of their annual cycle to connect with the farmers. And I would imagine that they saw the farmers as an additional resource on the landscape. You know, the farmers could have provided meat in the form of livestock. They could have provided grain, foods, various other things. They could have provided iron for making, say, arrow points or spear points and so on. There may well have been intermarriages between the two communities. There may well have been intermarriage, but that's something we would expect that to have happened, because for the farmers, what they would have been interested in is establishing good relationships with anybody else who was on the landscape. And marriage is one way of doing that, because it buys you a connection into another community. So I expect there would have been intermarriage, but that's something that we don't really have a handle on at this stage. I'm one of the things I'm particularly interested in is the way marriage work, the marriages, way marriage work within farming communities and the way marriages work between farmers and hunter-gatherers. And so we can look at ways at how these marriages actually worked if we apply our minds to this kind of thing. So that's the one major kind of interaction that we see in KwaZulu-Natal. Then as far as the second community farmers, what it looks like, what the archaeological evidence suggests, is that there's a second expansion of farmers into KwaZulu-Natal region around about 1000 AD, between 1000 and 1100 AD. So that's 1000 to 900 years ago. And we think that these are the first Nguni speakers to move into Southern Africa. And they would have moved here from East Africa. So the way we can separate the two is by, again, looking at pottery style. There's such a sharp distinction between the pottery style of the two groups, between the first millennium chaps and the second millennium people. And again, that interaction between the two is a future research topic. That's something we really need to look at. I had an extraordinary find on a site that I've been excavating recently called Inchagan near Muden in central KwaZulu-Natal, where we found features with both early Nguni pottery and early Iron Age pottery in the same feature. These features contain pottery of both types, and they're clearly different kinds of pottery, clearly two different styles. So this strongly suggests to me marriage between the two communities. And again, marriage here is kind of something to develop political alliances between two separate communities. It's a way of ensuring that you have an in with that community, that you can have positive relationships with that community. But I'm really interested that there's some extraordinary pots that have come out of the site from this interface period. And they some of them look like early Iron Age pots in style, but they look like they've been made by someone who wasn't raised, who wasn't schooled in early Iron Age pot making techniques. It's a kind of looseness. They don't have the same sort of precision that some of these early Iron Age pots have. There's a kind of looseness and perhaps even the sloppiness about them. So it's quite extraordinary. It looks like there may be people from some of these early Nguni communities have married into this early Iron Age community and are living with them and obviously making pots with them, but don't yet quite have a grasp of how to make pots in the early Iron Age style. It's quite an extraordinary pot. It's an extraordinary stuff here. So I'm hoping to delve into that project soon. Yeah.
Okay, and as we wrap up the conversation, and I you've sort of already given an answer to this question, but in terms of, you know, the research potential for those interactions between the late farmers and the earlier farmers, but what other research is coming out of the field of study in early farming communities? What other research could we look out for as people who aren't necessarily, you know, researchers ourselves, people who are, you know, just civilians and, you know, but wanting to know more about where we might have come from?
I think one of the most exciting things to emerge recently is the work on DNA, ancient DNA. So it's possible to sample skeletons of these early farmers and do analyses on their DNA and identify, one can build sort of kind of partial biographies of each individual. It's quite extraordinary what can be done. You can look at the resistance to disease they might have had, the possible diseases, genetically based diseases that they have. We can look at whether there's any admixture from hunter-gatherers or pastoralists into these communities. So there's a lot to learn, I think, from DNA analyses of these communities. And I would like to see some of that done on the first millennium samples, because I think we can learn a great deal. For example, we can address this issue around hunter-gatherer whether there was this kind of intermarriage, what kind of relationships they might have. We can, mm-hmm. that can help us, or not if we can address, but it can help us address that kind of thing. Then as mm-hmm. I mentioned, I'm actually interested in this interface with Nguni speakers as well. I'm generally interested in marriage. And then I'm just hoping to go into the field soon to work on some newly recorded silverleaf sites in northern KwaZulu-Natal around Lake Sabaya. And until these sites were recorded a year or so ago, we had no idea that there was any silverleaf sites in this province. So this is quite new, and they could well be significant finds. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we can get out of those sites, and hopefully that project will continue over the next couple of years. I think elsewhere, the Limpopo region, we can see there's some wonderful work that's been done on sites in Kruger National Park. And what we're finding increasingly is special purpose sites, like sites that are dedicated just to hunting, short-term hunting expeditions. The results from those kind of things in the Kruger Park are quite extraordinary. There are other special purpose sites like salt-making sites, for making salt. I think those are also pretty extraordinary. And there's mm-hmm. some wonderful stuff coming out around it for this first millennium period. Generally, I think that outside of KwaZulu-Natal, the ceramic sequence needs some tightening up. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to nail down what's happening with ceramic pottery styles in the northern part of South Africa, in Mozambique and Botswana and so on. There's some work to be done in just tightening up those style sequences. That's quite a big work to do as well.
All right.
There's one thing, I must mention this hunter-gatherer. We've got evidence now that these early farmers around about from about 700 AD, 800 AD, 900 AD, were trading ivory out into the Indian Ocean trade system. And the ivory seems to have been coming from quite extraordinary diverse environments. In other words, from a very wide catchment area. And one reason it might be coming for such a wide area, elephants being hunted over such a huge area, is because the farmers are actually involving hunter-gatherers in their ivory acquisition. And perhaps it's the hunter-gatherers who are attached to particular farming sites, and they are moving in the landscape and then bringing ivory from a very wide area into those sites, which then is moved out into the Indian Ocean trade system. And that's quite an exciting project, I think, that's worth looking at. Mm-hmm. With the relationship hunter-gatherers and farmers as far as ivory getting is concerned.
Thank you so much for joining us, Gavin. It's been very informative, and I hope, listeners will be able to, from the information you've shared with us, to be able to put together a relatively more consistent image of, that period that has hitherto been unaccounted for, I think, in a lot of people's imaginations.
Thanks, Nzama. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks very much.
Well, that's it, everyone. Thank you for joining us on Good Night, Sasania. I hope to see you again for the next episode. Good night, Sasania. Indeed, I'm a dreadful morning.